From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, Missouri lawmakers consider authorizing a land bank in Kansas City.
There's a lot of local investors, what we call the good investors, that we could work with to get these properties out of their blighted condition and into a condition that's an asset for the community.
Trees have been disappearing from our tree-lined boulevards. A new program hopes to start replacing them.
We don't know why those trees are missing, but we can guess why they weren't replaced. There wasn't money, there wasn't attention.
Plus a meeting of the tenor saxes.
On saxophone, it's like 10 years down the line before you can even sound remotely professional on the instrument. You know, it's just such a hard thing to get a good sound on.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. The foreclosure crisis hit some of Kansas City's neighborhoods hard, particularly neighborhoods that were already struggling with crime, disinvestment, and people moving out. As a result, there are parts of East and South Kansas City where blocks are pockmarked with vacant homes. The city would like to be able to acquire and sell off these properties quickly. That could happen with a bill that will have its final hearings in the Missouri State House this week.
The bill would create a land bank, which would allow the city to acquire unwanted properties, fix them up to sell, or demolish them, possibly to create community gardens or parks. David Park is director of Kansas City's Department of Neighborhood and Community Services. He testified in Jefferson City on behalf of the land bank bill. I caught up with him in his office in City Hall.
You know, if you can just figure the older neighborhoods with the where the property values tend to be lower, those are the ones that are been hit the hardest with the vacant foreclosed homes. Foreclosures have happened all around the city, you know, and not just in Kansas City, Missouri, but, you know, Johnson County, too. It's just that, you know, if a $200,000 house gets foreclosed on, it might then get sold for $150,000 or, you know, at a discount, which lowers everybody else's property values, but it gets sold, it gets reoccupied. It's for the very low-value houses. If you're talking at $7,000, $10,000, I mean, you know, fixed up, it might be worth $30,000. It doesn't take much in the way of needed repairs for that to get to the point that it's not a doable project. How many of those have we got? I mean, we know from our water records that there are about 13,000 houses across the city that haven't shown water consumption for a 90-day period, which we presume to mean that they're vacant. Of those, you know, we've estimated maybe 6,000 would actually fall into the vacant and kind of abandoned, you know, neglected category.
How many neighborhoods would you say have been the hardest hit?
Well, hardest hit, you know, starts getting to be a little bit of a subjective, but there's, you know, 100 that have been definitely, you know, noticeably negatively impacted.
Where did the idea of land banks originate? I'm wondering if you know sort of where that came up around the country.
Well, I can't say so much from around the country, but I think where I learned about it here for Kansas City was at the time that the federal government was coming out with the Neighborhood Stabilization Program grant, or that stimulus grant a couple of years, well, more like, what, 3-4 years ago now, I attended a video conference. It was it was kind of a seminar, but I went to the Kansas City Federal Reserve, watched it on a screen, and part of the program talked about land bank because they were encouraging that local governments use land banks as a way to deal with the vacant and foreclosed upon homes. And then I did some research into how a land bank operates, how the ones that were in existence then did help deal with the vacant and foreclosed homes, and, you know, look to see what we could do here locally to get one established.
And how exactly does a land bank work?
It works with the tax foreclosure process, so that properties that, you know, when owners don't pay their real estate property taxes, they end up in other cities, other jurisdictions, they'll go directly into the land bank. In Missouri or in Jackson County, Missouri, we have public auctions where those properties are sold. And then the way the land bank would work, if they're not sold at that auction, the properties would go into the land bank. The land bank would also be able to bid on the properties at the auction if there were any that they wanted on that. The land bank would also be able to receive donations from banks that have foreclosed upon mortgages. Many times they find out that they've really got a very low-value property. It's not selling. You know, it costs them more to keep mowing the yards and taking care of the house. They just as soon donate it to somebody and let them get it back, you know, put back into productive use. So the land bank would be an entity that could receive those donations and do something with the property.
So the bank wouldn't actually be purchasing properties that are for sale, or would it?
It could. I don't see that unless it's part of an overall strategy. If there's a strategy to, you know, trying to revitalize, say, a block or two within a neighborhood, there's a key property, it's part of that strategy that's owned by, you know, an investor or something, they might, you know, contact that investor and see if they'd be willing to go ahead and sell it or donate it so that it could be part of that revitalization effort.
But most of what you're suggesting are properties that aren't selling to anyone and would basically be sort of given to the land bank so that the bank could do something with them.
Correct, yes. And one of the things that we want to try to reduce is the amount of speculation that's going on. At a lot of the bank foreclosure auctions where they just auction them off, or even at our tax foreclosure auctions, what we've seen a lot of over the last few years is somebody from out of state will buy it. You know, maybe they are able to get it for $7,000. Then they turn around and flip it to somebody for $9,000 who has no idea what its real value is or how it fits within the Kansas City market. And they package them. You know, they've got, you know, maybe 10 of these that they sell as a package to somebody, and then they sell those off individually to others. And they just change hands from, you know, from one speculator to another. Meanwhile, the property sitting out there vacant, maybe open to entry, blighting the neighborhood. City spending money to mow the weeds, pick up the trash. So we want to, you know, if we can get at those auctions or from the banks, get control of those properties, then we can work with our local investors who do have an interest in actually taking the property, renovating it, you know, selling it or renting it. There's a lot of local investors, you know, what we'd call the good investors, that we can work with to get these properties out of their blighted condition and into a condition that's an asset for the community.
How is the land bank going to make these properties more appealing? And I mean, they're not selling already except to these speculators in many cases. What can the land bank do?
Well, in many of the cases, when that first speculator bought it, you know, I think in my example I said like $7,000, it would have value at $7,000. It just, you know, if it was, but not for the flipping. If you were, you know, saying, well, I can get it for $7,000, I can put some repair money in it, it'll still be worth what I can sell it for. It's just that after you flipped it four or five times, now you've got an artificial value in there that final investor wants that price for it. Well, it's not worth that. It was worth the seven. It's not worth what they're asking for it now. So if we can just get in on that chain earlier by getting the properties at those foreclosure auctions or instead of a foreclosure auction if the banks are donating it to the land bank, then we stop that cycle at the outset.
And you think that the land bank would then be able to sell it to somebody that actually could do something with it?
Yes. There are local investors that have been engaging in that business for years. They buy the distressed properties, fix them up, either resell them or rent them out. But they're making their money off of doing something with the property other than just trying to flip it to the next person. I mean, there's been studies that have shown like a vacant foreclosed home will lower the property values of adjoining properties by almost 10%. So that's, you know, 10% lower value of the house next door, across the street from it, behind it. So if you get two of those houses on the same block, yeah, now you're starting to get a compounding effect of it. Because those other property values are lower, now the feasibility of putting in repairs on those homes starts, you know, have a question. You know, if the property owner's got a roof to be replaced and, you know, they're looking at upgrading the property, well, do they do that or do they move on? And then, of course, the more you get of these, you start, you know, that old supply-demand question. We've got more houses than we've got the demand by people who want to buy or move into them. We've got to do something to interfere with that spiral and stop it. The neighborhoods are still wonderful neighborhoods. There are a lot of wonderful people that live in every neighborhood in our city. I'm out in the neighborhoods. I'm attending neighborhood meetings in all the neighborhoods. And they are, like I said, good places to live, wonderful people there, and we need to make sure that that message gets out too.
Do you think the land bank could have an effect on some of the neighborhoods that have the most vacant homes?
I do. If the land bank legislation gets passed and it's established in November, we're not going to see utopia next May. It's going to take some time to work back out of it, but I do think that it's one of the tools and a pretty key tool that we need to utilize here in Kansas City to lead us to improvements and a change in the population patterns where, you know, some of these areas that have been losing population start to stabilize and start to gain in population again.
Now, we do already have the Land Trust of Jackson County, which takes over properties where the property tax hasn't been paid and they haven't been sold at auction. Why do we need this additional tool, the land bank? How is that different?
The land trust is sort of a land bank. It was established in like the 1940s. The land bank will replace the land trust, at least within the part of Jackson County that's located in Kansas City. The land bank has more or would have more powers, if you will, than the land trust. Land trust cannot accept property from any other source other than that tax foreclosure auction. They can't accept the donations from the banks, for example. They can't bid at the auctions, the tax foreclosure auction, is part of that process. The land bank would be able to, after they sell property, then for the first 3 years, the real estate taxes from that property would come to the land bank to help cover their cost of operations. One of the thing that's hindered land trust is they really don't have the ability to generate the revenue necessary to carry out their program. As a result, you know, the city of Kansas City, Missouri spends, you know, this year it's probably going to be over $2 million maintaining properties held by land trust. Well, that's not fair to the Kansas City taxpayers. Land trust should be maintaining their own properties. They just don't have the revenue, and it's, you know, they're all well-intentioned folks. They just have a legal structure set up for them that just can't succeed.
The Show Me Institute has published a study that indicates that St. Louis's version of a land bank has rejected a lot of the offers to buy the property it was holding because it was holding onto it for future development. What's to say that doesn't happen in Kansas City and people who want to buy some of these properties and redevelop the neighborhoods won't be able to?
I'm not familiar with the reasoning behind in St. Louis why they're holding properties for future development. I know that the way that the land bank, you know, will get structured in for the Kansas City one is it's going to be it's very public, 5-7 member board, open meetings, open records. You know, it doesn't have a source of revenue other than the sale of the properties. It's not going to receive funding from the cities, funding from the county, funding from anywhere else. So, you know, a business model that says we're going to hold on to as many properties as we can just doesn't work for it. It can't survive that way. That's not to say they may not establish policies. The Genesee County Land Bank, for example, said it would not sell properties to out-of-state entities. They wanted it local. They wanted the ownership to remain local because that they found that those property owners were more likely to do something constructive with the property rather than just continue to flip it. So there may be some policies, something like that, to ensure that, you know, if we're selling a property, it's not just to somebody that's going to try to flip it and it's going to remain a blighting influence on the neighborhood going forward. We want to make sure that we sell it to somebody that is going to take care of it. Next door neighbors, most of the land banks, you know, have some sort of side lot, you know, for $25 or free. The next door neighbor can have it, expand the size of their yard. I would anticipate a lot of that.
The land bank will try and resell some homes, but will also demolish some in the cases where they probably would never sell.
Correct. And some of the cities like Detroit and Cleveland have, you know, said we've got so many houses Our population in these areas where the houses are located has been declining. Whole city populations in those cases have been declining. The likelihood of getting, you know, if we repaired them all, would enough people exist, you know, wanting to move into the areas to occupy all the houses after they're repaired? So they decided that that would not work, so that they are focusing a lot of their energy on demolition of the structures, kind of reducing the supply to get it more in line with the demand. There are areas of the city, I think, that would be true of, that the population trend has been people leaving. We've got lots of vacant houses, more of a supply than demand, so that we do anticipate that demolition is going to be, you know, a big part of our efforts to deal with the vacant and abandoned home problem.
David Park, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome. Again, thanks for having me.
David Park is the director of Kansas City's Department of Neighborhood and Community Services, at least until next week's City Hall reorganization. Two versions of the land bank bill are working through the Missouri legislature. The Senate will hold a hearing on one of them next week.
Coming up, a new partnership aims to bring the green back to Kansas City. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
It was Arbor Day on Friday, and if you spent some time outside in Brookside or Waldo this weekend, you might have seen some people planting trees. They are trying to replace thousands of trees that are disappearing from our neighborhoods. Casey Currents' Carrie Coogan looks into why and how some of those trees will be replaced.
Walk any neighborhood in Kansas City, Missouri, and you can't help but marvel at the stretches of unique and majestic trees that line the streets, parkways, and boulevards.
This is a great parkway. I mean, this is a boulevard.
Jim Summers of Heartland Tree Alliance is walking in the right-of-way near Meyer Boulevard. That's the city property between the sidewalk and the street.
And Kansas City is really proud of its boulevards, its wide streets that were put into place long, long ago during city planning.
He points to where the trees used to be. It's not nearly as green as it was when this boulevard was first built, dating as far back as the late 1800s.
If you look at the street, you see tree, tree, blank space, tree, tree, blank space. It's lost trees over time. We don't know why those trees are missing, but we can guess why they weren't replaced. There wasn't money, there wasn't attention given to that site at the time, and a tree wasn't replaced.
Summers can't tell you what happened to a specific tree, but according to the Kansas City Parks and Rec Department, we lose close to 4,000 trees a year. The problems vary. Old age, disease, power lines, and repairing water mains. These lost trees are just the ones they know about. There could be many more that go unreported, and until now, Jim Summers says there has never been a designated program to replace them.
And when you're on that downhill slope and you're not keeping up, you're in danger of never catching up.
But now there's a new program to replace those trees. The tree plantings are part of a pilot program underway with the Parks and Rec Department, the Heartland Tree Alliance of Bridging the Gap, and members of local homes associations. They're all working together to replant 500 trees this spring. The homeowner then promises to take care of the tree as if it were their own.
So this is a way to respond to that need with volunteers, giving people who will be living with those trees the responsibility of planting and caring for them.
The trees are being donated by Forest Relief of Missouri, a nonprofit in St. Louis that grows trees for distribution to community groups and cities throughout the state, free of charge. Summer says it's all possible because of volunteers like Jim Roddy. He's standing outside his colonial-style home watching his kids play in the front yard.
We just sort of were the first people in the door. And since we were a smaller neighborhood, we were just able to get it organized a little faster.
Roddy lives in Oakmire Gardens neighborhood. It's one of four neighborhoods that will get new trees, trees he considers an investment.
If you plant a tree to the south of your house or to the west of your house, the shade that tree provides 30, 40, 50, 60 years later lowers your cooling costs in the summer. It raises the value of the neighborhood to have big old trees, and it's good for the environment, and it's good to see, to plant something and see it grow.
What will that something be? Many people don't want just any tree, even if it is for free. Laura O'Brien knows what she doesn't want to see.
My neighborhood has a bunch of sweet gum trees, and while they're gorgeous in the fall and provide great shade, I probably would be happy if we didn't have too many of those because of the sweet gum balls that they produce so much of. I'd love to see either some flowering trees like redbuds that are native, or I think it would be really cool if residents had the option of fruit trees.
You don't get to pick. It's, you know, we're talking about a public space tree. The city has always picked that tree, chosen that tree. Because of the limitations, we will be picking the trees. We can say, to answer that fear, no London planes. That seems to be the main concern, that we'll plant London plane trees and people will be dealing with those little spiky balls up and down their sidewalks. And we won't be doing that, at least.
Is that the sweet gum tree?
Yeah.
No sweet gums, but there will be red buds, oaks, and even some dogwood trees. What variety of tree you will get will be based on the space in front of your house.
It's still a free tree. It's still the support of people to show you how to plant those trees. And Heartland Tree Alliance will come back with its trained tree keepers in 2 years or whenever it's necessary and help them also do some early pruning and some care of those trees too. So they also have the full support of this organization for the next several years as well.
And along with these new trees, the city and volunteers will be planting seeds of a partnership. They hope to see the program continue with more tree plantings in the fall and in the years to come. For Casey Currents, I'm Carrie Coogan.
If you want to find out how to get your name or your neighborhood on the list to get new trees, contact the Heartland Tree Alliance. Find information on our website at kcur.org. Now, what was the original plan for Kansas City's treescape, and how has that changed? To find out more, Susan went over to Parks and Rec and sat down with archivist Ann McFerrin.
The park board that was created in 1892 hired George Kessler, and he was a young man at the time. Most people don't realize how young he was. He was born in 1862. So when he was hired by the 1892 Park Department, he was only 30 years old. And he worked with ideas that he had learned growing up and being trained in landscape architecture and engineering, and with his own thoughts on how things should work with the natural environment. And he laid out the basic plan for developing a park and boulevard system in Kansas City. For a number of years, several people had been talking about trying to improve the looks of Kansas City. And so they finally took it in hand and started making a plan to work with. And by doing that, as in most everybody's life, if you make a plan and you aim toward that plan, you're going to be succeeding and you're probably going to be doing better. Well, the same thing with the parks and boulevard system. They laid out a general plan, knowing from there they could grow as the city grew. And that was very helpful to the growth of Kansas City.
Now, at that time, how far did that plan stretch, given that Kansas City was kind of more compact at that time?
I'd have to look up to see what the city limits were at that particular time. Even when Swope Park was given in 1896, that was outside the city limits, way outside the city limits. But they knew that eventually the city would go that way, and it did, of course, but it was not really in the city limits at the time it was given to the city of Kansas City. But I know the earliest days, I believe the limits were 31st Street. About there was the southern limits of the Kansas City Park, and then it went out a little bit further and a little bit further.
What was the idea of having trees and their importance to the early city then?
Well, trees were involved in the earliest reports of the Parks and Boulevard commissioners, including the 1893 report. Trees are basically part of life. They're part of the natural landscape of a city or of a country. And trees have always brought people pleasure. Just as a natural course of events in discussing the development of parks and boulevards, trees are naturally included.
Of course, Kansas City is known for its boulevards. How do the boulevards and parkways differ from regular streets in terms of the early planning?
Parkways incorporate aspects of parks that, if you look at a street like Ord Parkway with the median down the middle, it didn't exactly start off totally that way, but there are trees, there are fountains, there are little pools and things to help bring a feeling more of a park than just a street that you're driving down.
But how did that differ from just regular streets in terms of how the city approached trees?
Well, the city actually planted trees all over the place as the city developed. Kansas City's always found trees very important. And unfortunately, in the 50s and 60s, we were hit by something called Dutch elm disease. And many of the Kansas City trees that had been planted many years before were destroyed. Elms were trees that were incorporated into the city plan of streets and boulevards because they're lovely trees. They would gracefully drape over the streets themselves, and they're kind of a soft tree so that you'd lose some limbs, but they're very pretty. And but they were, many of them were killed off at that time.
So based on your research, when they were killed off, did the city then plant other trees to replace them, or what was the plan?
Well, I'm not totally acquainted with it, but yes, they did plant other trees that would be more sturdy, some like maples and sycamores and trees that wouldn't be as susceptible to disease like that.
Now, you talked about elms and sycamores. Are these native trees or?
Elms are not native to this area, but they were brought in. The 1893 report talks about planting trees like elms, Carolina poplar, Norway maple, linden, ash, and soft maple trees to create shade, a lot of shade. More native trees are oaks, hickories, walnuts, redbuds, and dogwoods. And, of course, redbuds and dogwoods are smaller trees, so they wouldn't create the shade that some of the others would. And that's what the early planters were thinking about, nice shade trees where people would go to a park, and there's a shady area even today. If there are trees in a park, people have a tendency to gravitate toward the trees. One of the things that they did with the planting of trees in the very early days were to plant several rows of trees on the side of a what would be a boulevard or a parkway. You could have two rows of trees or three rows of trees. And that was done to create sort of a mini nursery for the trees so that when the roadway was widened, they could take out a row of trees and plant them someplace else. And the parade, which is a park today, there's a quote in the 1905 park report that talks about taking some of the trees away from the boulevards that have been planted too deep and putting them in the parade or some of the other parks around so that when they took away those trees, there were still other trees left there. So that's how important trees were, so that you take away some of the trees, but you still have trees there.
What kind of questions are typical questions that you get from people about the past in your work?
The Parks Department's very conscientious about the past and trying to work with it. George Kessler is very well respected to this day, and they realized the principles that he helped lay out over 100 years ago helped make Kansas City what it is and notable. Kansas City is internationally known for its parks and boulevard system, and the Parks Department here is very conscientious about that and try to work with it because they know that they aren't like quite any other city, and it's because of the plan that was laid out in 1893 and following that.
Ann McFerrin is the archivist for the Kansas City Department of Parks and Recreation.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. KCUR's own Walt Bodine broadcast his final show on Friday before entering into full retirement. And for that occasion, Laura Ziegler has this story about Walt's influence on KC and KCUR.
He's a Kansas City tradition.
Oh, he's an institution.
His time spent in Kansas City, there is value to his words.
To many Kansas Cityans, Walt Bodine embodies the gravitas, authority, and the experience old-time newsmen once had. When Walt retires today, he'll have earned recognition as an award-winning radio and television broadcaster, a pioneer of the talk show, a newspaper man and author, a columnist, and a commentator. Here he is in one of his famous What Do You Say to That? Pieces for Channel 9.
Well, political season is on us again. And we have the Washington Post poll. We have the ABC poll. And here in Kansas City, I have the one I always do because I go out to the barber shops to find out what people are talking about. We call it the barber poll.
Walt this cut his teeth on television when the medium was brand new. He started with WDAF in 1947, and he worked there for almost 20 years. When Walt worked for Channel 9 in the 80s and 90s, Alan Ball was his photographer.
Yeah, he's from the old school. I mean, police scanners was his life. When he worked at Channel 9 and he'd get in the cars, he'd listen as you're driving along. He probably knew more policemen as friends than politicians.
But radio has long been Walt's passion. His storied career includes Night Beat on WHB, The Walt Bodine Show on KMBZ, and, of course, on KCUR, where many public radio luminaries have stopped by.
When you write a sketch like Guy Noir and so on, you write all those? And I heard somebody ask you once whether you had people with you when you did it, and you said, you really have to be alone to write, don't you?
Are you asking me if I write the Guy Noir script?
Yeah, that's
Walt, right. Is that what you want to know?
That's the idea, yeah.
She walked into my office in the Acme building.
Beautiful.
Her pants were so tight I could read the label.
Walt's appreciation for Garrison Keillor mirrors his own love of the story and of storytelling. In the late 1980s, I asked him to share some of his experiences in a piece on the sounds and smells of Kansas City. He talked about Sanderson's Cafe, for years a late-night downtown eatery.
You know, I was in there one time. This is a fact. I was in there one time about 3 o'clock in the morning. Sitting on my left was a federal judge. And on my right was a wrestler. And just next to him, a couple of stools down, was a lady of unknown profession, but you could kind of guess it.
This wasn't the first time I mined Walt's exhaustive memory for color commentary or historical detail, and I wasn't the only one. In his decades at KCUR, Walt was a resource and a mentor to many producers and reporters. General Manager Patty Cahill says his last broadcast is a milestone.
While we are excited about the programming we are bringing to our listeners, with Walt's retirement, the 10 to 11 o'clock hour will never be the same on KCUR.
Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
I feel lucky that I got to work alongside Walt Bodine a few times. I even got the opportunity to be his co-host. I remember the one time we interviewed a young nonfiction writer, Ian Klaus, who, although we were talking about his book about living in Kurdistan, is better known for being the ex-boyfriend of Chelsea Clinton. Now, in talking to Walt before the show, he said, don't say that right away. Maybe after the first break. And then, slyly, after the break, Walt asked the question. And he knew full well the answer because we had discussed it beforehand. Who did you dedicate the book to? Ian Klaus blushed as if he was talking to his own grandfather and got into such an interesting discussion about dating an ex-president's daughter. Walt seems to have always known what people will be interested in, and he's such a master conversationalist, one of the wittiest people I've ever met who's not at all mean. I developed a habit the few times I sat beside Walt in the studio. It's his voice in my head saying, don't read a script, just start this thing off naturally, and it's something I strive towards. Walt was public radio before there was public radio. NPR and some of the other programs on KCUR have become more fast-paced, more news-driven, more scripted, too. But he's always reminding us to go where the listener wants to go and to savor the digression. Thank you, Walt, for all you've done for Kansas City and for teaching so many of us here at KCUR. We want to replay something that aired during Walt Bodine's final broadcast on Friday, Marilyn May's tribute song.
Hello, dear Walt. Congratulations. And may I say, you know you've got our praise and all our thanks today. So many shows on the radio, from Sedalia to Casey Moe. So many years, that's a fact. You've always had great wisdom. So what do you say to that? When you were on the air, your info was the best we've heard. You wrote your books with great care. You skillfully chose each word. You've lived your life in broadcasting. You've had everlasting enthusiasm all the way. And now we send you our love today. So may I say, Mr. Walt Bodine, we honor you with great esteem. We have listened well to you, and as always, it has seemed to be a much better world. All Kansas Cityans knew that you would speak your mind, your truths, your beliefs, and you would always find at the end of your day, you've made a much better world. You've given with your talents, your great knowledge, oh, you're wise. You've interviewed all walks of life. Yes, you deserve the prize. You have loyal friends and fans, a loving family too. So today they're joining hands to say, Walt, we do love you. So the time has flown by. For 72 years, you've been the star. The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. You've lived and followed your dream for a much better world. And with you, dear Walt Bodine, it's been a wonderful world. Congratulations to you, Walt, on a highly successful working life. Now live every day in joyful satisfaction and great pride while we say thanks to you. Cheers from Marilyn May.
That was Marilyn May's tribute to Walt Bodine for his final broadcast before entering full retirement on Friday. Download the song, read the lyrics, and find lots of information, testimonials, archives, and photos on our website, kcur.org.
After the break, two tenor saxophone players team up in a new local band. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Walt Bodine retired after 72 years in broadcasting. A judge let streetcar plans keep rolling, and there was progress, but not resolution, on a Missouri budget. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Early in the week, the chances for action on a Missouri Senate budget bill seemed slim, as Cape Girardeau Senator Jason Crowell took the floor for a filibuster.
I had no idea that blind people were the problem, that was why we were going broke.
Crowell wanted to rein in tax credits and restore funding the House cut from a Medicaid program for the blind. He got his way on one of those, as Appropriations Chair Kurt Schaefer said.
We found a reasonable way to make blind health care more self-sufficient without general revenue.
Whether Crowell got a deal for some tax credit reform remains to be seen, but there'll be a battle when the Senate and House negotiators meet on the budget. House Speaker Stephen Tilley was still insisting on cuts to the blind programs. Kansas, House and Senate negotiators reached agreement on tax cuts. The plan reportedly lowers personal income tax rates, phases out all income tax for 119,000 businesses, and reduces the state sales tax come June of 2013. After several hundred people demonstrated against Governor Sam Brownback's plan to turn programs for persons with disabilities over to private managed care companies, the governor backed down and said those programs will remain as they are for another year. His spokeswoman said the governor still has confidence the managed care system will work, but Tom Lang, spokesman for agencies that serve the disabled, said,
"The facts are telling him what they're telling us, which is that this thing is not ready to go forward."
A Kansas Senate committee also drafted a bill that would give racetracks a bigger take from slot machines that would encourage tracks like the Woodlands to reopen. Jeff Rutland of the Kansas Horse Association said the present law just costs the state money.
The people that race and raise, breed, and run horses and greyhounds had to leave the state to compete in other states.
But low on the priority list, the bill may never make it to the full chamber's floor. Health IT giant Cerner broke ground on its new Kansas City, Kansas campus near the Speedway, and co-founder Cliff Illig quoted an impressive figure.
"The people here will be responsible for the continuous operations of more than 30% of U.S. health care."
The complex involved $200 million in incentives and is expected to generate 4,000 area jobs. The new Premium Waters bottled water plant in Riverside got almost $2.5 million in incentives from Missouri. Riverside Mayor Kathy Rose commented,
"We're like 70% dependent on the Argosy, and we don't want to be in that position forever. So if we get other businesses and other sales tax generators and things going on down here, then we're going to be able to alleviate some of that a little bit."
The plant will open in November. Kansas City-based H&R Block, meanwhile, announced plans to cut 350 jobs nationwide and close 200 company-owned offices. Wrapping up the week, a judge said Kansas City can roll ahead with plans to create a special tax district for a downtown streetcar line. The Royals finally broke their long losing streak, and saving the biggest story for last, Walt Bodine retired after 72 years as a news reporter and interviewer in a career that included newspapers, television, and, of course, radio.
"I describe myself as a multimedia public nuisance."
The Walt Bodine Show came to KCUR in 1981.
Thank you very, very much for listening. Thank you very, very much for all you do for KCUR.
Back in Kansas City's classic jazz era of the 30s and early 40s, it was not uncommon to hear a full stage of horn players making music together. Today, jazz doesn't draw nearly the audiences or the money that it used to, and it's rare for a paying gig to feature more than one horn player. Rather than collaborating, horn players are most often forced into competing for gigs. But two of Kansas City's best sax players are defying the trend to form a new band featuring two tenor saxes. Alex Smith has their story.
Matt Otto grew up in Laguna Beach, just south of Los Angeles, and he studied at the Berklee School of Music. In addition to living and playing in L.A. and Japan, he spent some time in the jazz capital of the world, New York City. There, he saw the extremes that horn players went to, not just to find gigs, but just to get a chance to play on stage.
You know, going to the Smalls jam session, for instance, it was just, like, ruthless. I mean, the session would go all night long, and like one tune would go for an hour easily, and there'd be a line of like 14 sax players, like literally in a line waiting to play the next solo, and every guy is just trying to outshine the next, and it was aggressive, you know. And it was very when I first moved to New York, it was very intimidating, and it's like you kind of get a thick skin pretty quick, or you just stop going, or both, you know. I did my time, and then after a while, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to put myself through this, like, competitive, like, it's a jazz as a sport. It's like I didn't sign up for football, you know.
Meanwhile, Arkansas native and fellow tenor sax player Rich Wheeler spent the last 12 years working in the somewhat friendlier music scene of Kansas City. When Matt settled in Kansas City about 3 years ago, he was skeptical about the jazz that he would encounter, but hearing Rich play convinced him that our town had a lot to offer. Matt spent his first 2 nights in town listening to Rich play with Brandon Draper and then at a jam session.
Monday night, the jam, it was Jeff and Rich, and I think it was Mike Warren. And
I think Roger was on.
Roger, yeah, and, you know, I sat in with him. And the night before that, I heard this band, Brandon Draper's band. I heard that band the very first night I was in Kansas City, and that was pretty mind-blowing to, like, come to the Midwest and think it's going to be all about just, like, blues. Like, I didn't know much about the city, and hearing that band playing, like, modern, very modern, progressive, sort of odd-meter jazz very well, you know, and I was really excited. I was like, wow, this is going to be really fun to move here.
It's not too surprising that Matt and Rich would become friends. They'd spent most of their lives in the often thankless pursuit of mastering the tenor saxophone. The instrument is an almost comically complex tangle of keys, rods, springs, and pads, and long before a player can reach a level of artistry like Matt or Rich, just learning to make this contraption sound good is a feat of its own.
Probably the hardest thing is getting a consistent sound, I would say.
Yeah, it's one of those instruments that, like, for instance, you could take your guitar to a lesson, and in the first lesson you can play a G, and it's going to sound like, you know, it's going to sound pretty good, like a G, and you're going to be making music already. On saxophone, it's like 10 years down the line before you can even sound remotely professional on the instrument. You know, it's just such a hard thing to get a good sound on. So
yeah, it's the old joke, you know, it takes a lot of work to sound bad.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and actually all wind instruments are like this. It's, you know, you have to deal with the physical side of tone production, which takes a long time to sort of build up the you know, the air capacity and the concept of how to do it and the embouchure and all that stuff. You know, I mean, it's the same thing with trumpet or, you know, something like that. But sort of unlike piano or stringed instruments, you know, we have to constantly deal with the fact that there's a real physical side to playing.
On the surface, Matt and Rich aren't dramatically different players. They both like dark tones, and they're both strongly influenced by John Coltrane. But they do have at least one major difference. We're listening to Matt playing on his new Yamaha tenor. Now, here's Rich on a recording with Ala Turka. He's playing a vintage Selmer horn from the 1930s. Now, for most listeners, the horns sound about the same. But to saxophonists, the choice between a new or vintage horn is a big one.
Rich plays a nice old vintage Selmer, and I play a brand new Yamaha. And I used to play vintage Selmers. I mean, I actually switched just merely because of the financial reasons. Like, the upkeep of, like, Rich's horn compared to mine is, like, no comparison. And it's just, like, when I want to replace the horn or, you know, change something, it's so expensive if you're playing old Mark VI Selmers or Super Balance or Balance Actions. But that said, like, that sound, like, you can't, those are the best sounding horns probably ever made in my opinion. So I basically compromised and said, well, you know, ergonomically it feels better, it's cheaper, I'm going to go with this modern horn, and I'm going to suffer the consequences and try to make up for that with doing long tones and working on my sound.
Also, with vintage horns, you tend to have a lot more things like pitch issues. Modern horns tend to be a lot better in tune than older horns.
Well, you know, on the cost of the vintage horns, you know, how much would it cost these days for somebody to get, like, the same horn as John Coltrane or Dexter Gordon played?
Oh, geez Louise. Well,
I mean, over $10,000.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I've got a Balanced Action. It's like a late 30s Balanced Action. And there's no way I could afford to buy it now.
It's like, it's worth probably at least twice as much as my horn, maybe three times.
I think there's collectors and stuff like that that are willing to pay top dollar for these horns that are really, they're really, at this point, getting pretty hard to find because they're pretty old.
And there's not that many that play well anymore.
Right. Most of them are worn out. You know.
In addition to performing regularly, both Rich Wheeler and Matt Otto are also saxophone teachers, and they share similar ideas about musical influence.
One way or another, sometimes unintentionally, in fact, you're influenced by everything you've heard. Like, you know, what you play like today is sort of a conglomeration of every piece of music you've heard since the time you were old enough to process it. And, you know, I think, like on the horn itself, I think we all have influences that come, you know, playing tenor, for instance. Like for me, probably Dexter Gordon was the earliest one that was a big influence, but like people like Hank Mobley and John Coltrane and Ben Webster, Coleman Hawkins, and then modern guys as well, you know. People like Michael Brecker, I guess, Donnie McCaslin, some of the, you know, the more modern guys. All of that, everything that you hear from any of those people, like, say, almost from an unintentional standpoint, it's going to show up in your playing, you know. For me, I used to listen to, like, just tons of saxophone players. And then as I've gotten older, I find myself listening more to guitar and keyboard players than I do saxophone players.
When you hear recordings of yourself, you know, improvising, can you identify where different parts of your playing come from?
Oh, sure. You know, it's totally unavoidable. I mean, you know, you're always going to have those kinds of things kind of poking through, you know. And, it, you know, if you go back and listen to, like, even, like, people like Coltrane or stuff like that, you can listen to what they're doing, and it, you can find little nuggets inside that that were people before them. I mean, you can, you know, everybody is constantly sort of incorporating stuff that they've heard from other people. I usually get annoyed with myself if it's real literal. Like if I hear something and I know that exactly what it was, then I'm just kind of like, oh man, really? Right. Everybody's going to know what that is.
Didn't disguise it at all.
Exactly, yeah. You know, it's like...
Like New York and L.A., Kansas City doesn't have enough paying gigs to support its jazz talent. But that hasn't turned all of our musicians into gladiators. Instead of competing, Rich Wheeler and Matt Otto see sharing the stage as a chance to collaborate.
I have a huge amount of respect for Matt and the way he plays, and I think in large part playing a gig with him, it's more about trying to keep up than anything else. And so it's like, it you know, anytime you get to play, like, as a tenor player, it's like in a small group setting, it's fun to end up playing with another tenor player because it never happens generally. Right. I mean, like, if you're on the gig, that usually means there's not another horn player, typically, you know? And so when you get to play a gig like that and, you know, you can both play at the same time and you can, you know, play with another horn player that you have a lot of respect for and really like the way they play and, you know, maybe try and bounce some ideas back and forth on stage, it's, yeah, it's a pretty fun situation.
Tenor saxophone players Matt Otto and Rich Wheeler will debut their new band on Thursday, March 3rd at the Westport Coffee House. Their rhythm section includes bassist Matt Leifer, keyboard player TJ Martley, and percussionist Sam Weissman. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Carrie Coogan is our intern. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.